The story we're about to examine is more vivid than a soap opera. It's full of colorful personalities. There's a mixture of joy and tragedy, of laughter and sorrow. It's a true story that involves sex, religion, and politics. To start it off, let's turn to Matthew 1 in verse 1. In Matthew 1 in verse 1, it starts out about a description of the background of Jesus Christ and how he came to be born of human parents. In Matthew 1 verse 1, it starts out, "The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham." In verse 2, "And Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat Judas and his brethren, and Judah begat Phares and Zerah of Tamar, and Phares begat Ursam," and so forth and so on. And we read on through verse 14, listing all of the selected ancestors of Jesus Christ. And we will notice that there are five women listed in those 14 verses that are listed in the genealogy of Christ. We're going to take a look at the life of one of those women to see why she was listed in that select list of women. But first of all, I want to call attention to the women who were not listed in the genealogy of Christ. Not listed, but obvious, was Eve, the wife of Adam. She wasn't listed. She was the first human mother. Not listed was Noah's wife, although she was also the next, the mother of all who came after. Not listed was Sarah, Abraham's wife, in this genealogical listing. Not listed was Rebecca, Isaac's wife, nor was Leah or Rachel, the wives of Jacob, listed. And yet the five women were Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba, and Mary. And there is something in common among those five women. And if we think about what's in common with those five women, it's simply this. Under ordinary circumstances, they shouldn't be there. We're going to examine the life and lessons regarding the first woman listed in Matthew 1, a woman named Tamar, because there's profound lessons for us today from the story of her life. We're going to see some of the reasons that she was listed as an ancestor of Jesus Christ and how the lessons of Tamar apply to our lives, and especially and including the upcoming Kingdom of God seminars. The story of Tamar has more twists and turns than a mystery novel. As they say, truth is stranger than fiction, and this story of Tamar's life is rarely told, if ever told, probably because it's terribly awkward, extremely embarrassing, and often unseemly. The story of Tamar is told to us throughout the entire chapter of Genesis 38. You might want to put a bookmark in Genesis 38 because we're going to refer frequently to that chapter. I do want to point out that the previous chapter is Genesis 37, and that chapter is all about Joseph, the son of Jacob, who was the grandson of Isaac and the great-grandson of Abraham. And Genesis 37 tells us about Joseph's dreams and how Joseph was sold in slavery to Egypt by his brothers. And then there comes chapter 38, which is the story of Judah and Tamar. And then after that chapter 38 comes Genesis 39, the story of Joseph's life in Egypt. And that includes the story of how Joseph rejected the illicit advances of Potiphar's wife and wound up in prison. In other words, the events that occurred in chapter 38, the story of Judah and Tamar, is happening at the same time as the events that occurred in chapter 39, the story of Joseph while he was in Egypt. So after we go through the story of Tamar, we'll come to see what a contrast that the life of Judah had as compared to the life of his much younger brother Joseph. Of course, the woman Tamar is inextricably intertwined with the life of Judah, who was one of Joseph's older brothers. Now, Judah was the son of Leah. Judah was the fourth son of Jacob and the grandson of Isaac, great-grandson of Abraham. In other words, his parents, or his father and grandfather and great-grandfather, were known as the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It was Judah who was able to convince his brothers that they should not kill their younger brother Joseph. It was Judah who suggested that the brothers could make some money by selling Joseph to some trading travelers. We can go to Genesis 37. In Genesis 37, we can see, read that for ourselves. And Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood," meaning hide his death? And verse 27, in chapter 37, "Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites," which were their cousins, "and let's not lay a hand upon him, for he's our brother in our flesh." And so forth, and he was sent to verses after, talks about how Joseph was sent to Egypt. Genesis 38, then, we move on to Genesis 38 verse 1. It sets the time frame for the story of Tamar. In Genesis 38, 1, and we'll start there, and we're gonna plug our way through some of Genesis 38. "And it came to pass at that time." That time was just after Joseph was cast into a pit. Just after Joseph was sold to the Ishmaelite traders and then transported to Egypt. "And it came to pass at that time," continuing on in verse 1, "that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira." Hira the Adullamite will appear later in the story, so we'll want to make a mental note that Hira was Judah's friend. In verse 2, in Genesis 38, verse 2, "And Judah there saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite, a woman who was indigenous to the area," meaning they of the tribes that lived there before the conquering of Jericho and Joshua, who fought when the Israelites came up from Egypt. There were indigenous peoples called Canaanites. "And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her," meaning he married her. And verse 3, "And she conceived and bore a son and called his name Ur. And she conceived again and bore a son and called his name Onan. And she conceived and again and bore a son and called his name Shelah. And he was at Shizai when she bore him." In other words, Judah got married and had three sons. So the three sons were Ur, Onan, and Shelah. The Bible commentary by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown noted that Judah did just like his uncle Esau, and he married outside of their religion into a Canaanite family, and that such a marriage was contributor to the problems that were to follow, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. And this is where Tamar is now introduced into the story. First of all, and I've arranged this, and oh, I don't know, I didn't actually count. I put a number on the points, but I didn't look at the total numbers. So, number one, Judah arranged for Tamar to become the wife of his eldest son, Ur. So Judah arranged, so that's the first stance happening here when we hear about Tamar, that Judah arranged for Tamar to become the wife of his eldest son, Ur. And that's in Genesis 38 in verse 6. So we're just following through the chapter. "And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, whose name was Tamar. And it was the custom in that day that fathers generally arranged the marriages for their children. My children were a little twitchy about that when I offered to take care of that selection process for them. But this was especially important at that time for inheritance purposes. In other words, they did not want to dissipate the family inheritance. So the father would select the bride. And in this case, Judah, you notice it says, took a wife for his firstborn. So Judah made the selection. He was with his buddy Hira, and said, "Hey, here's a woman. I want this woman to be the wife for my eldest son because she will be the mother of the boy that will inherit everything that I have someday." And so, and verse 7, "And Judah's firstborn son was wicked in the sight of the Eternal, and the Eternal slew him." Actually, one way to interpret that. Another way is that his wickedness caused his own death. Number two on our linear path here for following the life path of Tamar, number two, Judah then arranged for Tamar to marry his second son, Onan. Now, this happened after the firstborn son died. The second son was then, according to the Levirate principle or Levirate law that if a man died without having a son, then the dead man's brother was to marry the widow and raise up a son to inherit the dead man's estate. And so this is what was happening in this case. Now, there's two laws of inheritance that are in play here. And the Bible doesn't use these words, but these are the principles that it describes. The one was called the law of primogeniture, and the other one is the Levirate law of marriage. So under two, where Judah arranged for Tamar to marry a second son, Onam, I have point A is about primogeniture. What is primogeniture? That's the right of the firstborn son to inherit the entire estate, or in the case of some Hebrew tradition, the eldest son inherited a double portion. So if there were three sons, as there were in this case, the eldest son, the estate would be divided into four parts. The eldest son would inherit two of the four parts, a double portion, and then the younger sons would each get one-fourth of the estate. So it depends upon which custom they were following, whether or not the eldest inherited everything. For example, if a person were a king, his eldest son would inherit everything because the king was the government. He had a responsibility for the country. So you have the law of primogeniture, and we can refer to that. I'm just going to refer to it today. Deuteronomy 21:15. It spells it out that if a man die and his widow has no children, it's a brother's responsibility to raise up a child for him, and the eldest son is then an inheritance of the elder brother who died. There's interestingly enough, there's a New Testament example of this in Luke 15 and verse 11, and that's the parable of the prodigal son. The same principle. The youngest of two sons who wanted his share of the family estate, he wanted it early, before his father died. Well, what was it? The man, and it starts on in Luke 15:11, and Christ said, and a certain man had two sons. Well, what that means is, under inheritance, the estate would be divided three ways. The eldest son would get two-thirds of the estate, because he got the double portion, and then the youngest son would get one-third of the estate. So the youngest of them, in verse 12, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me, or that I will inherit. And the father divided unto them his living, or all of his estate. So the father here had reserved the double portion. Two-thirds of his estate went to the eldest son, and then he gave the youngest son one-third of all he had, which is really quite remarkable. This is not done while the father is yet alive, but the father in this case did it. And, of course, we know the story about the prodigal son. I'm not going to follow through that. It's for another time, but that's just to show the law of primogeniture was expressed in both the Old and the New Testaments. And then under point two, we also have the letter B, I put, the Levirate law of marriage. And I've spelled it three or four different ways in my notes until I finally got it down right. And that's L-E-V-I-R-A-T-E, the Levirate law of marriage. The term, L-E-V-I-R-A-T-E. The term levirate is a derivative of the Latin word lever, E-L-E-V-I-R, which means husband's brother. And in Deuteronomy 25, and verses 5 through 10, it'll talk about the Levirate law of marriage, and I'm not going to, on the basis of time today, I'm not going to read all of it, but it's referring to Deuteronomy 25:10. Where it's the responsibility of the brother to raise up a child for the younger brother to marry the widow, raise up a child for the dead brother. The principle has been around a long time. It's a form of this Levirate principle. It's practiced today throughout Asia, Africa, and many other cultures. And in some cases, it depends on whether or not the widow had children or not. The Bible says that they were not to do it unless the widow didn't have any children to raise up an inheritance for the dead man. It's happened in my family where my grandmother married her first husband's brother. And they had a marriage of over 50 years. Same name, same family. And I've mentioned those things before. In the time of Jesus Christ, the Sadducees questioned Christ using the Levirate Law to challenge Christ regarding the resurrection. We read about that in Matthew 22 and verse 24. And this is where the Sadducees were challenging Christ, saying that if a man die and have no children, his brother shall marry his wife, and his brother shall marry then the wife and raise up seed to his brother. And then the following verses in Matthew, after Matthew 22, 24, it goes on to describe that the woman marries seven brothers and none of them have any children. Then in a resurrection, whose wife will she be? In other words, it's understanding and acknowledging that principle and then trying to place Christ on the hook, saying, aha, we got you now. But back to the story of Tamar. It was following then this levirate custom that Judah instructed his second son Onan to marry Tamar. And that's in verse 8, Genesis 38 in verse 8. And Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and marry her and raise up seed to your brother. Now, and verse 9, and Onan knew that the seed should not be his. And so then Onan refused to have a child, as the verse goes on, in his brother's name. And as a result, Onan died, verse 10, and the thing which he did displeased the Eternal, wherefore he slew him also, meaning he allowed him to die. Onan did that which was wrong. So we aren't given the particular of Ur's death, and we aren't given the particulars of Onan's death, except that they did things wrong, and they died. So we're left to speculate why Onan did not want to have a son by Tamar. But it's not a difficult speculation. Because, you see, Onan's son by Tamar would have legally been considered to be Ur's son. And the primary heir to everything that Ur would have inherited, and Ur would have inherited what Judah inherited. And basically, Onan would have been then reduced to a lesser inheritance. Whereas if he didn't have any children, he would have gotten the full double portion. He was the next son who would be the heir. Interestingly enough, and if you go back and look at the timeline, Judah's father Jacob, also called Israel, was alive at that time. And Judah was in line to become the chief inheritor of his father's estate, as well as his own. That meant that Jacob, or then Israel, his estate would then go to Judah, and then Judah's estate would go to Onan, unless Onan had a son under his brother's name. And Onan would be left out. He wouldn't have the bulk of the estate from Jacob, he wouldn't have the bulk of the estate from Judah, and he would be left to his own devices. So there was a lot of money riding on the line by reason of inheritance of Judah's son and grandson. Of course, then you may say, well, why in the world did Judah? Was he in line to inherit from his father? Because he was the fourth-born son. And I thought we talked about the law of primogeniture where the eldest inherited. Well, Judah became the son to inherit. And we read that in 1 Chronicles in 5, verse 1. And I'm going to refer to that because the sons, it talks about Reuben disqualified himself because Reuben was the heir, but he disqualified himself moral depravity, and his birthright was given, was given, it says, to the sons of Joseph, which is the eldest son by the second wife. And the genealogy is not to be reckoned after the birthright. So the genealogy proceeded through one of the first sons, and Judah prevailed above his brethren, and of him came the chief ruler, but the birthright was Joseph. So there was now a separation where there was some inheritance on one side and inheritance on the other side. But of course, Judah was still the fourth son, so how could the fourth son be? And we read about that in the matter of the case of Dinah, which was the only sister of the 12, all of the brothers that Jacob, of the sons that Jacob had. In Genesis 34 and verse 25, it talks about Simon and Levi. So the eldest sons were Reuben and then Simeon and then Levi. And in Genesis 34 and verse 25, it talks about Simeon and Levi, the two brothers, had a sister named Dinah. And the And we can go through that story, and really that's really a story for another time I want to develop. But Dinah wanted to marry a local fellow, and that entire family and all of the village decided that they would honor Jacob's God and the worship and the customs that Jacob did. And they agreed to be circumcised, and so they were sore and couldn't move. And during that time, Simeon and Levi went in and slew all of them to prevent Dinah from marrying them. And so Simeon and Levi had blood on their hands, and they disqualified themselves from being Jacob's primary heir. We read about that in Genesis 34 in verse 30. And so we'll leave that the story. But basically then Judah, his eldest son Ur was dead. And then having no heir, Ur had no heir, the second son then became the heir, Onan. And Onan wanted to keep clearly the estate to himself if he didn't have a child with Tamar. Now, Onan may have figured in his own mind that his father was old. And after a while, if he didn't have a child with Tamar, and he then proceeded to inherit the estate, he could pick his own wife and have children that would be named after him, and so forth. I can easily see how that thinking could come about. But in any event, he didn't want to be bound to having a child with Tamar, but Onan's plans didn't work out so well, because Onan died and left now Judah's third son. And his was third son named Shelah. And what, according to that Leveret principle, who's in line to marry poor Tamar? She's lost two husbands. She's been widowed twice. But let's pause for a moment. Why didn't Tamar simply inherit her own husband's estate? Each time her husband died, that's what happens today. And that would have settled the matter, right? She inherits her husband's estate. But that's not the way the world worked at that time. After all, the wife wasn't actually an heir, but the right to marry the wife was a legal issue. It was to be decided by the husband's next of kin. That means the right to marry Tamar was a heritable right. It could be inherited. And that's exactly what was happening. So the laws of inheritance, normally speaking, and I'll give a reference to that, but I'm not going to, we're not going to go there in the interest of time. In Numbers 27, it talks about the daughters of Zelophehad, there were only daughters and there were no sons, and they came before Moses and said, you know, there are no sons, you know, to inherit our fathers and keep our father's name alive. And so, Moses then said, well, in this case, because there are no sons, then the daughters, can inherit. There's another well-known biblical principle where the Leveret law was practiced, and the right to marry the widow was an inheritance right and involved real estate in particular, and we'll cover that one closer to Pentecost when we read the book of Ruth. And we can read about that in the book of Ruth, in chapter 4, in verses 1 through 12. And it's interesting that there's some striking similarities between Tamar and Ruth by the Leveret law of marriage, is that in the book of Ruth and in verse 12, in Ruth, chapter 4, verse 12, it even says, let your house be like the house of Pharaoh, who Tamar bore unto Judah. In other words, even in the book of Ruth, they're saying, like, you know, just in your case, very much like Tamar, where there were similarities, where the wives, where the relative of the husband had a responsibility to follow through. The third point on the line as we follow Tamar's life, Judah told Tamar to return to her own father's house until Judah's third son, Shelah, was grown. And that's in Genesis 38 and verse 11. And Judah tells her, just go home. In other words, you don't want to live. You don't have, your husbands are dead. You aren't going to live in my house. So you need to go to your own father's house. And indeed, in verse 11, that's what Tamar did. So Tamar went home. She was twice widowed, but she was now both a widow and a betrothed future wife, waiting for the third son of Judah to be old enough to get married. So Tamar was sort of in a netherworld, sort of in between. She wasn't married, but she wasn't free to contract another marriage. She was at once both a widow and an engaged woman, and the only place she could live was back in her own father's household. Okay, the fourth point on Tamar's lifeline is that Tamar waited and waited and waited. In Genesis 38, in verse 4, Tamar waited for Shelah to become grown. And what occurred during that time? Judah's wife died. So in other words, Judah said, nope, Tamar can't be in the house. Or maybe it was Judah's wife that said that Tamar can't be in the house. Sometimes mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law don't get along so well as the proverbial Naomi and Ruth did. So I can easily see that. I recall from my daughter Crystal explaining the Japanese symbol in Japanese character writing, that the symbol for peace was a picture of a house with one woman in it. And the picture, the symbol for war was a picture of a house with two women in it. So, I mean, that's the culture goes around the world. So it appears to me that it could very well have been that this was a reason that Tamar should go home to her own parents. And Genesis 34 and verse 4, Tamar waited for Shelah to become grown. Judah's wife died. Shelah grew up, but Judah did not arrange for Shelah to marry Tamar. Now, there's a lot in that one verse. A whole lot happened in a whole lot of time, or could have taken many years. So Judah delayed the marriage of Tamar to his third son. After all, we heard about it earlier, just a few verses before, verse 11, 38:11. Where he had told her to go home and wait till Shelah become grown. So obviously there's some age difference between the oldest sons of Judah and the youngest son, Shelah, and they weren't really marriageable age until adulthood, which was 20, so clearly the youngest son could have been quite a few years younger than the Ur and Onan. So Judah delayed the marriage of Tamar to his third son, thus delaying the eventual birth of a son by Tamar to inherit that portion reserved for the eldest son, Ur. If we take a look at Exodus 22, verse 29, we hear about the subject of delay. In Exodus 22, verse 29, you shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe fruits and of your liquors, and the firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. The principle here is that you don't delay when there is a responsibility. When you have a responsibility, whether it's an offering or it's a family circumstance. And Judah delayed. So when he delayed it, he didn't, or perhaps more correctly stated, he didn't follow through on his agreement. He was condemning Tamar to a lifetime of widowhood, because she couldn't remarry at that point. She was in that in-between world. He was condemning her to a life of childlessness. And by condemning Tamar, he was also condemning her to eventual poverty, because she wouldn't inherit anything from her father, and she would have no children to look after her in her old age. So in that sense, Judah was oppressing the widow Tamar. We read about oppressing widows in Zechariah in chapter 7 in verses 9 and 10. In Zechariah in chapter 7 verses 9 and 10. And thus speaks the Eternal of Hosts, saying, execute true judgment and show mercy and compassion every man to his brother, and oppress not the widow, nor the fatherless, nor the stranger, nor the poor, nor that let none of you imagine evil against brother in your heart. If we go to Exodus 22, verse 40, I think I have the wrong verse there. Because now I have verse 22 down. I think it's Exodus 22, verse 22. You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. And if you afflict any them in any wise, and they cry to me, I will surely hear their cry. And my wrath will wax hot. And it goes on to say, I will kill you with the sword, and your wives will be widows, and your children fatherless. In other words, there will be a penalty if people are afflicting the widows or the fatherless children. So by delaying or denying the marriage to Sheila to Tamar, Judah was setting himself up for a very nasty fall. Now here we go to point number 5 on the timeline of Tamar's wife. Number 5, meanwhile, Judah's wife died. So that was a marking point there. And we read that in Genesis 38 and verse 12. In the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shears to Timnath, and he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. Remember Hira? Hira is where he found his wife in the first place. Hira was his friend, the Adullamite, his buddy, in the beginning where he first found his wife Shua. Interesting, what is an Adullamite? Adullam was one of the 14 kingdoms that were defeated by Joshua during the conquest of Canaan. You can read about that in Joshua 12 and verses 17 and 15. And the region that was conquered by Joshua was then assigned to the tribe of Judah. So the Adullamites were then the neighbors, the indigenous people that were the neighbors of the tribe of Judah. So it makes sense that Judah would know some of the resident Adullamites. So point number 6, in Tamar's life, going along on Tamar's lifeline, with no marriage on the horizon, but with the legal right to bear the child, Tamar became impatient and decided to take matters into her own hands. You see, riding on the line was who was going to bear the child that would be the heir of the substantial future estates of both Judah and Jacob. And Tamar had a very big interest in that, not just a legal right, but a very big interest in not being a destitute widow. And so now we read what Tamar did in Genesis 38, verse 14. That would certainly have a rating if it were on a movie show that would not be for children. In Genesis 38:14, she put on her widow's garment from her, because widows were expected to dress in a way that was easily recognizable as a widow, and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in an open place, which is by the way to Timnath, for she saw that Sheila was grown and she was not given him to wife. In other words, it said many years had passed. Sheila was now an adult. And so Tamar, taking matters into her own hands, knew that the time was limited for her to have a child. She now was scheming to become pregnant. She had the legal right to bear that, the inheritor of Judah's estate. But if she wasn't going to be able to marry Judah's third son, Sheila, then she would have to find another way to become pregnant and bear a son to inherit all of that, those estates. And Genesis 38, verse 13, it was told to Tamar, saying, behold, your father-in-law goes up to Timnath to shear his sheep. So she knew, she had, somebody told her, hey, he's heading up there. Remember, that's where his buddy Hira is from. According to the Bible commentary, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, the sheep shearing season occurred in that area near the end of March. And that's when a time when wealthier owners invited their friends and servants and treated them to dining and parties after the end of each day's work. Now in verse 14, 38:14, Tamar is beside the road. She's disguised herself. She's wearing a veil. In verse 15, when Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot because she covered her face. Now ordinarily you'd think that Judah would have recognized Tamar. After all, he picked her out to be a wife for his eldest son. He had to have known her fairly well. He had instructed her to marry his second son. But after the second son, it's likely that Judah did not see Tamar for over 10 years, maybe 15 years, and possibly almost 20 years. Because Tamar went back to live in her own father's household. Plus, of course, Tamar did have her face covered with a veil. Now, we're going to read in verse 16, and I'm just going to paraphrase verses 16 through 18, that afterwards, they were bargaining at that point, and Tamar said, well, you know, basically, what can you pay me? for this dalliance. And Judah agreed, verse 17, to send her a kid from the flock. That was worth a certain amount of money. And Tamar said, well, what will you give me as a pledge until you send it? In other words, I'm not going to trust you. I want something, I want proof that you're going to send me something of value. And so, and he said, well, verse 18, Judah said, well, what do you want? What pledge do you want? And she said, your signet, your bracelets, and the staff in your hand. And he gave it to her. And that's when, after they had struck the bargain, that Tamar conceived. You notice that Tamar bargained and she was determined to have proof positive, without a doubt, that it was Judah who was going to make her pregnant. Now, she had to know about her time of month, she had to know where she was, and she also knew where he was in order to arrange this conception. I went to my old college textbook that I still have on my shelf after these years in my Old Testament survey class. And I pulled out the book. It's entitled Old Testament Speaks. It was a commentary by a Samuel Schultz. And he notes that the Ugaritic and Mesopotamian sources, that three items are required for personal identification. And that's what Tamar did. She obtained Judah's signet. We don't know if it was a ring off his finger or if he just wore it on a rope or a chain around his neck. And his bracelets and his staff. Each of these items had to be personalized in some manner so that everyone would recognize them. So Tamar's efforts to get three items of collateral to back up Judah's pledge isn't much different than what we need to get a driver's license. You've got to have several other pieces of ID, or to get a social security card, you have to have several other pieces of ID. And the same thing was occurring now with Tamar. She was getting three, not one, not two, but three, so that it would be unquestionable that she would have collateral for that pledge. And of course, if we read about, and I'm only going to refer to it in Exodus 22, the rule regarding pledges, Exodus 22 and verse 26, if you take a pledge, there are certain things that you must deliver quickly on it. You can't hold the collateral over. The principle there is, I'm not going to read it, but it had to be redeemed very quickly. Of course, so Judah, let's go on in Genesis 38 and verse 19. And Tamar rose and went away and laid by her, took off her veil and put on the garments of her widowhood. In other words, she went home. Verse 20, and Judah sent a kid, meaning a young goat, by the hand of his friend, who? His friend the Adullamite, his buddy Hira, to receive his pledge. In other words, get his identification back from the woman's hand. But the Adullamite did not find her. And of course, they go on. And look for in the following verses through verse 23 that the Adullamite couldn't find her and said, well, I just can't find the woman. There is no harlot by the road. Nobody knows, hasn't seen a harlot by the road. Now you notice that Judah trusted his buddy Hira, the Adullamite, to keep his mouth shut. He was a close friend. Hey buddy, would you clean this mess up for me? And go take care of this. So they were old friends. But Tamar took home the three things, the identification. So, and if Judah even knew who held the pledge, he couldn't very well go and demand that he get the items back, because that would be embarrassing and revealing by itself. And also, it wasn't the custom to search out a pledge to redeem the items. We read about that in Deuteronomy 24, and verses 10 through 13. When you do lend your brother anything, you shall not go into his house to fetch his pledge. In other words, there are limitations. You wait for the other person to return the collateral. Verse 11, you shall stand abroad or outside the house, and the man to whom you did lend shall bring out the pledge outside to you. So in other words, he says, Judah said, all we can do now is wait. That's what we're going to have to do. And he was perplexed, because now his identity was seized by a woman who he did not know. Point number 7 on the timeline of Tamar's life is that Tamar's pregnancy was discovered and Judah condemned her to death. And this is Genesis 38, verse 24. And it came to pass about 3 months afterwards, which is time enough to know that morning sickness has set in and the monthly cycle has been interrupted. It is told to Judah, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law has played the harlot, and behold, she is with child by whoredom. And Judah said, bring her forth and let her be burnt. It's interesting that Judah ordered Tamar to be burnt. And according to one commentary that I read, death penalty by burning was only done in that area to a daughter of a priest, whereas the death penalty by stoning was the method that was normally used in a capital punishment case. And in Leviticus 21, verse 9, if the daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by playing the whore, she profanes her father, she shall be burnt with fire. In other words, it was a big no-no, it was a special circumstance. So Judah, in other words, his daughter-in-law was as his daughter, legally, because she was bearing his offspring, or his future heir, or was supposed to. So therefore, he's pulling out the law. This is, aha, she did that, therefore let her be burned. In short, Judah set himself and Tamar up to a very high standard, the standard reserved for priests, by declaring that by Tamar being pregnant out of wedlock to be burned rather than stoned. According to the Bible commentary by Schultz, burning of harlots was practiced also by the Hittites and the Philistines in that region. That's true in the book of Judges when it talks in 15:6, where it talks about Samson and the circumstances with regard to Samson. And it talks about where a woman was burnt who was taken away and given to another man. Schultz's commentary goes on to point out that the fulfillment of the levirate obligations of the father-in-law in marrying a widowed daughter-in-law was allowed among the Hittites, although not among the Israelites. In other words, among those who Tamar grew up with, it was acceptable. If the sons couldn't provide a child, then the father-in-law was expected to do so. And after all, his wife had died, he was no longer married, so it's obvious to see how Tamar's thinking would have been. He's the responsible one. He failed to keep his end of the bargain. And so under local law, not Israelite law, Tamar would not be subject to punishment for her deception of Judah. So regardless of how this death penalty was supposed to be carried out, the judgment that Judah said to kill the woman conflicted with the principle that a pregnant woman could not be put to death because that would kill an innocent life. In Genesis 38, verse 25, we move along with the story. And when Tamar was brought forth, she sent for her to her father-in-law, saying, By the man whose these are, I am with child. In other words, she was bringing forth the pledges. And I pray you, whose are these? The signet, the bracelets, and the staff. In verse 26, and Judah acknowledged them. He had no choice. It was obvious. And said, she has been more righteous than I because I gave her not to Shelah my son. And he knew her again no more, meaning he did not take her to wife. See, Judah was openly embarrassed. He was shamed by the revelation that he was the father of Tamar's pregnancy, and he had just condemned Tamar to a horrible death to be burnt. He openly confessed that by comparison with to himself, that Tamar had acted more honorably than he did, and several different levels. And further, as the facts became known, Tamar had the legal right to bear Judah's child, but it was Judah who acted dishonorably. So, of course, this was very publicly and widely exposed, and it was that Judah was under greater condemnation. And, of course, remembering that Jacob, also named Israel, was still alive and was well aware, apparently would have been aware of what was going on. After all, this was his future inheritor and inheritance as well. So it was embarrassing because Judah was found out in front of his father, too. And it's a pretty big one. So timeline number 8, Tamar had twin sons, one son to replace each of Judah's eldest dead sons, Ur and Onan. In Genesis, and Tamar had twin sons. In chapter 38, verse 27, it came to pass in the time of her travail born that twins were born in her womb. And if we stop and do the math, it's even probable that Tamar was 35 or probably 40 at the time she became pregnant. She had married two successive husbands who had both died, and she waited 10 or 15 years, maybe more, for the third son to grow up, and the likelihood for twins triples when a mother is 35 years of age or more. And so the age difference between Tamar and Shelah, maybe the 20 years, may have been uncomfortable for Shelah to marry. And again, if he didn't marry her and didn't produce a child, he would have inherited everything. And so you could see that mindset working. And then there was the unusual circumstances of Tamar's, the birth of Tamar's twin sons. We can read about that in verses 28 through 30, and I'm going to paraphrase. That basically, the one child stuck his hand out first in the birthing process, and so the midwife tied a string on the finger, yet the other child was born first. Now, because there was confusion in the birthing process as to which of the sons was firstborn, each of the twin sons had a technical claim to being firstborn. This, again, was important back to the law of primogeniture, with the claim of the firstborn son inheriting a double portion. So by the birth of twins, each twin having a claim on being firstborn, Judah's third son, Shelah, was no longer the chief inheritor, was no longer in second place, but it slipped back into third place behind his younger two brothers, the younger twin brothers. So they had a higher claim to the estate now of Jacob and Judah. So had Judah kept his word and honored the levirate marriage law, Judah's third son, Shelah, would have taken Tamar as wife. And then Tamar would have borne Shelah's son, and the inheritance would have gone on. However, that didn't happen. And the rest, they say, is history. Interestingly enough, in 1 Chronicles 4:21, when Shelah later did marry and had a child, he named his eldest son Ur after his elder brother, which, interestingly enough, appears that it may have been a hope and an opportunity that perhaps by doing so he would bring the inheritance back into his family. But of course that doesn't. Of course, naming someone after their uncles can be confusing. It happened in my neighborhood when I was growing up. I remember there were two Ed Ottos, uncle and nephew. So when we always had to say old Ed or young Ed, even though young Ed may have been 70 and old Ed was 98, you know, that was, and the same with Henry Otto, we referred to old Henry or young Henry. Now, I never knew old Henry, I only knew young Henry, and young Henry was always old to me, but that was the nature of it, that sons were named after their uncles. Interestingly, the sons of Shelah would have been born in Egypt after they had gone, so they would have been born considerably later. And if we read who all went to Egypt in Genesis 46, in verse between the lines, and we can just read who's in that listing and who's not, and I'm not going to read all of that section for time, but in the first 12 verses of Genesis 46, it says, you know, who's all, you know, they're going into Egypt, and it starts reading the names of all the children of Israel, verse 8 in Genesis 46. It says that, if Tamar was still alive then, she would have gone on to Egypt with Judah and Judah's household, and she was a grandmother by that time. So we don't know all of the details of the time, but certainly some time, considerable time had passed. and we can read about who all went to Egypt also in Numbers 26:19. So we can read it. Now I want to take a look at what are the lessons that we can learn from this awkward story of Tamar and Judah, the lessons from the life of Tamar. And the first lesson was, and the parallels are here, that God the Father is the author of our calling. In the physical sense, Judah was the father who arranged the marriages for his sons. He was the one who chose Tamar to be the mother of his descendants. Judah reinforced that calling when he instructed Tamar to marry his second son, and later contracted for Tamar to marry his third son. She was called to be the mother of Judah's heir. She was chosen then to become a member of the tribe of Israel. Similarly, God the Father has chosen us to be in his kingdom. In John 6:44, no man can come to me except the Father which has sent me draw him, and I will raise him up the last day. So no man can come except the Father call him. And in Acts 2:39, about God. God is the Father is the author of our calling. For the promise is to you and to your children, to all that are afar off, even as many as the Lord our God shall call. So our calling comes from God. We've been chosen to become members of the spiritual tribe of Israel, just like Tamar was called and included in that. The Father included her in that family. The Apostle Paul, writing to the Galatians, referred to converted people as being part of Israel, of God, regardless of our actual biological ancestry. And I'm just going to quote that in Galatians 6, or refer to it as Galatians 6 and verse 15 and 16, and he ends by calling them, as many as walk according to the rule, peace be on them and mercy and upon the Israel of God. In other words, those that follow God's way are the Israel of God. But however, unlike Judah, God keeps his own word. And that's in Psalm 119, 160. The word is true from the beginning, and every one of your righteous judgments endures forever. So, from Tamar, number one, God the Father is the author of our calling. Number two, we're to hold fast our calling. We're to hold fast our calling. Now, in Tamar's case, a very physical case, Tamar hung on to her calling, however imperfectly and however impatiently. We are also told to hold fast to our calling. In Job 27, verse 6, my righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me so long as I live. In other words, he was holding fast to his claim to righteousness. In Hebrews 10, verse 23, let's hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he's faithful that promised. In other words, holding fast to the profession of our faith. That's another example. And 2 Peter 1:10. Wherefore, 2 Peter 1:10, wherefore, rather, brethren, give diligence to make your calling and election sure. For if you do these things, you shall never fail. So, point two is, so we are to hold fast to our calling. Number three, we will be part of an arranged marriage. Judah selected and arranged for Tamar to be the bride of his sons. This is a physical prototype of God's arrangement for us. Christ gave himself gave this example in Matthew 22 in verse 2. And he goes on, and that's the a parable in Matthew 22, 2. The kingdom of heaven is like unto a certain king which made a marriage for his son. I'm not going to go through the parable. But he likened the kingdom of heaven to a marriage. And then in Matthew 25, verse 1, it starts the parable of the 10 bridesmaids, where again, God, through Christ, refers to our joining him in his kingdom as a marriage. So it's an arranged marriage. And in Revelation 19 and verse 7, let's be glad and rejoice and give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and his wife has made herself ready. Verse 9, and he said to me, write, blessed are they which are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are the true sayings of God. So we are to be part of an arranged marriage, just as Judah arranged the marriages for his sons. Fourth point of Tamar's lessons from Tamar, God emphasizes the importance of the firstborn and his inheritance. This emphasis on the firstborn in the story of Tamar is a physical prototype, a forerunner, what may happen spiritually, that Jesus Christ would be the firstborn of many brethren. You see, the firstborn belongs to God. And we read that in Exodus 34:19, that all that opens the matrix is mine. Jesus Christ, of course, was the firstborn in his immediate human family, as we read about in the story of his mother Mary. But Jesus Christ was the firstborn person from the dead, the firstborn into a new resurrection, and then became the hope and destiny of mankind. We read that in Colossians 1 and verse 18. Speaking of Christ. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, and in all things he might have the preeminence. In Hebrews 12:23, it's described that we are the church of the firstborn. In fact, it's stating it flat out, to the general assembly and the church of the firstborn, which are written in heaven. We can be part of that first resurrection. The writer of the book of Hebrews calls this than the better resurrection in Hebrews 11:35. But what this writer is spelling out is spelled out clearly in 1 Thessalonians 4, and I realize I'm throwing a lot of verses here at you. And I'll just refer to 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 16, where the dead in Christ shall rise first. The Apostle Paul also wrote to the church at Colossus about Christ being the firstborn of the dead, the firstborn of the spiritual resurrection. And Colossians 1, verse 15, when Paul wrote, he said, "Who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature?" And we're referring, and then verse 18, "the head of the body of the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, and that all things he might have preeminence." In other words, describing Jesus Christ being the firstborn, the value of that, the value of our calling. So God places a value on our calling, that our own determination to make our calling sure, on the understanding that we're part of a marriage, an arranged marriage through that calling with Jesus Christ, and that we'll be among the firstborn in the family of God. So the story of Tamar prepares us to understand two chapters in the New Testament that in particular speak to our understanding of salvation. So once we've understood the story of Tamar, then we can read Ephesians chapter 1 and Hebrews chapter 1. And I would encourage you to read the whole chapter in each one of those with that understanding of the story of Tamar and about the inheritance that we've learned from that story. So the lessons from the life of Tamar: God the Father is the author of our calling. We are to hold fast in our calling. We'll be part of an arranged marriage. And God emphasizes the importance of the firstborn and his inheritance. So we all have hope to become the heirs of God, to be counted as firstborn with Christ, and to inherit the eternal life in the kingdom of God.